You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Interstate Batteries has been a proud supporter of the Sportsman's Nation since day one. So if you're looking for any type of batteries, whether it's for your truck, your car, your trail cameras, your rangefinder, stop into a local Interstate Batteries retail location. There are thousands upon thousands of them all over the United States. Talk with a battery specialist and get the batteries that you need to go on with your life. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you. All right, guys, welcome back to another Land and Legacy podcast here. Yes, 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 we are coming back from Texas during this podcast, a great consulting trip, but want to give a little bit of a disclaimer here. You know, there's a lot of people who don't hunt Texas, may not ever hunt Texas, and you may have seen this podcast and you're like, I don't really know, guys, I'm not interested in Texas. The point of the podcast is to really think about going back to the basics of management of that animal that you are looking to manage for specifically. You know, if you've grown up in the East or the Southeast and you've never hunted out West, or if you've grown up in the Southeast and you've never hunted up North, you've never gotten outside of your comfort zone, you know, you're missing probably a lot of potential details of that specific animal that you're looking to manage for, what they need in varying landscapes. So this podcast, again, even if you don't have an emphasis on Texas, it still will be very helpful for you to kind of get inside of our brains as to, okay, typically, yeah, we may not be working in areas of rainfall as low as this here in Texas, but the biology of the white-tailed deer is still the same. Whether that deer lives in Texas or whether it lives in Tennessee, it does not matter. We've got to completely think about 365 a year as we're managing these properties and offering the type of habitat and cover that they need specifically for that animal to function at its highest and highest individual function and fitness, and then make the land as let's say healthy and clean functioning as possible. So be sure to give this podcast a listen, even if you're not in Texas, or if you've never hunted Texas or you don't know what Texas is all about. Still, it's going to make you a better deer hunter and a deer manager. But before we get into that, let's first give a shout out to Vortex Optics. Guys, they just came out with a new apparel line for the fall of 2020. Fantastic stuff. A lot of new options from flannels to great new graphic t-shirts, hats, everything. On top of their optic lines, it's all awesome, guys. Adam and I just got a couple new rifles, topped them with a Vortex scope, and actually tomorrow I'm going to get on the range and get it tuned in, sighted in, and I'm excited to see what this fall is going to bring with the new rifle of choice. And go check out vortexoptics.com. Give them a like, follow on Instagram, social media, and I hope you guys enjoy this podcast. I think you will. So give it a listen. Appreciate it. Alrighty, here we are back again. I've got Kyle Hedges with me. What's up, man?
Hey, glad to be along on this trip.
Yeah, we are, as you can probably tell, on the road, traveling. But guess where we're coming from? That's right, Texas, the big state of Texas. It is early October. Well, actually, no, I guess it's still late September.
No, today is October 1st.
Wow. Yeah, okay, today is October 1st. So we have spent 2 days in Texas working. And so this podcast is going to be centered around what it is we saw, dealt with, observed, and the management strategies, techniques that are basically recommended are going to be deployed to these two different properties. And honestly, I'm excited to talk about it because I don't know if you could truthfully spend 2 days in Texas and find much more contrasting properties than what we were on. I mean, it's a huge state, right? So though it occupies a giant land mass, but we saw central westernish Texas one day, drove 4 hours east, and we're in eastern Texas, not far from Louisiana, on the next day.
Yeah, totally different habitat type, totally different landscape, everything.
I mean, just night and day.
Yeah. Yep.
Night and day difference. And the other part that we're going to talk and touch on a lot, not only is the habitat different, but the climate, like the ecoregions of these two areas are vastly different. We're going to talk about rainfall. We're going to talk about the humidity. We're going to talk about just one being essentially arid and one being, like, on this property, there was a bayou. Like, it wasn't called a creek. It was a bayou in East Texas. And there was nothing very bayou-like in Central or West Texas. Like, that word is just, like, foreign. So we've got much different strategies and approaches to wildlife management and what they're trying to achieve on these properties. But deer and turkey were a strong focus on both of them. So the same species that you're looking to promote occupy different types of spaces, utilize different plant species, plant communities in one versus the other. So therefore the approach has got to be different.
Yeah, and then these properties are in completely different climates to some degree. I mean, sure, rainfall events, temperature, humidity, completely different, being 4 hours apart, drastically different. So those animals have different stressors depending on where they're at. The plant responses are way different, you know, 4 hours apart due to rainfall or lack thereof on one property. So everything changes just to where you're at in the landscape. And this was essentially, I mean, we might as well have just been in two completely different states pretty much.
Right, right.
I mean, we were. It was more or less in Louisiana for one and what you would normally expect for Texas on the other one.
Correct. And I think it's important. Let's just break down kind of like day one. And the first day we started, we were good ways west of Dallas, but relatively kind of north central-ish Texas. But this was a 240 acre property, very flat in that general region. And we're talking mesquite. We're talking some live oaks, post oaks, some elm, lots of cedar, but an area that should have been prairie or would have been prairie, right?
Yep.
Years and years ago, but a different type of prairie than what we were dealing with today when we were in East Texas. And we'll get into that later on. But essentially, there was not prairie there.
Yeah, there was remnants of little pieces, glimmers, you know. There was little blue stem in a few places where the sun was getting to the ground yesterday in the north central Texas property. Blazing star. I mean, we found some indicator species saying, hey, I was here.
Yes.
You know, 500 years ago. I'm still here. I'm still hanging on.
Right.
A lot of it is, you know, past land uses. Some of it had been farmed, the north central place. Some of it had been farmed in the recent, well, not even, you know, 50 years ago. Less than that.
Right.
So all of that has effects on what we're seeing today. And and how we're going to manage it in the future, those past things and what has happened. It's a lot different if we're going to try to recover maybe a prairie from it's been overgrazed or maybe sprayed. You see a lot of that in Oklahoma.
Right.
Versus one that's been farmed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some of those species are never coming back.
Correct.
So all that history was important, and we were able to gather a lot of that from the landowner, and a lot of that just from walking around, our own intel and observations, and,
yeah.
and certain plants tell us those things, too.
Yes, yeah, for sure. And so a lot of what we were dealing with, like I said, they're named off a couple species, but it's relatively prairie-like, and we had some larger dominant post oaks, live oaks. We did see blackjack, elm, a lot of cedar, and just tons and tons of mesquite. And so it makes it unique and provides different challenges, right, to create the proper habitat out of those features and out of those vegetation types that were there, especially when you look at the climate and the rainfall. And so this one property in North Central Texas, we're looking at 21 inches of rain, correct?
Yep.
Annually?
Yep.
And you looked up, Kyle, prior to the podcast, the average U.S. rainfall is 38 inches. And you're like, oh, that's not that, it's not that crazy. But every inch makes a humongous difference. And when you compare it to what we're at today at 50 inches of rain, that is two worlds apart from each other.
Yeah.
Vastly different.
Yesterday's consult is on a property that gets 40% of the annual rainfall of where we were today.
I mean,
it only gets half of the annual rainfall of the average place anywhere in the U.S. So,
and for, I guess, to put it in a little bit of perspective for people, it's like, okay, well, guys, what does that mean? Well, say you're trying to plant a food plot, right? Well, you need rain for a food plot. Well, what if you reduce your annual rainfall by or that fall plot rain that you'd like to be getting by 40%, yeah, it's going to make a big difference, a big, big difference in what you actually see happening on the property. So the disturbances, fire, grazing, and dormant season disking, all those things are going to be completely different when you only have 21 inches of rain a year.
Yeah, you're going to have a slower response than an average year from a lot of stuff. And then, of course, we know that's just average. So you're going to have some dry years. You're going to have some wet years. But you got to kind of plan for those and prepare for those. So we won't be near as aggressive in some of the disturbance regimes for an area that only has 21 inches of rainfall, because the recovery time for the vegetation that we want is a lot longer.
Right.
If we do some of these disturbances and happen to get hit with a dry year, wow, that's okay. Stuff will grow.
Sure.
But it may not look like we want it to until the second growing season in an environment like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Well, like for instance, yesterday, what do we see at both properties? And people have different names for them. Doveweed was one of the names, and the other property was goatweed. But croton.
Croton all over.
Croton all over both properties. But one happened to be about 12 inches tall, and another one happened to be, it was probably 2.5 to 3 feet tall.
Oh, yeah. It was knee to thigh high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the same plant, but when you look at that response of that annual coming back, it's like, wow, there's a humongous difference here in the height and regeneration of that, or the propagation of that plant in 1 year based on rainfall. And so that changes, again, that disturbance interval of how quickly you can come back to disturb a site with whatever techniques that we're talking about, fire again, dormant season disking, but those, it just drastically changes. Yet we're still managing the same wildlife species. And I'll remind everyone, we're driving back from Texas, so that means we're in the state of Oklahoma now, And if you hear the roads, sorry, but they're not the best roads. So it's like I can hear the tires and the bumps and the cracks and all those things. So apologies, but it's not going to be the smoothest ride here on the way back.
Despite paying tolls at like four different places.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, but that's another podcast subject.
Yes. So obviously there's some challenges, but Kyle, I'll let you kind of talk about some of the management techniques and some of the things that, okay, in this North Central Texas property, from a stressor standpoint, what is it that we need to address and make sure the habitat is providing, and what are those, and then how are we going to do that with, let's say, the species that we saw present or we know we could get to grow there on the property?
Yeah, and so this guy yesterday, he was interested in overall land management, but but he was keyed up on deer, quail, and turkeys, probably in that order.
Yep.
A very active deer hunting program there with him and his family, even he and some friends. They want quail on the property. They see quail on occasion, so they're around. And then they've begun hunting turkeys on this property. So they're fortunate. It's only 240 acres, but they have these species already on the on the property. So, you know, right off the bat, we got to be thinking about multi-facets here of we need nesting and brood rearing.
Yes.
That becomes very relevant to the overall program that we're going to set up for this guy, as opposed to if we were only looking at if this guy's only goals were deer.
Yes.
Fortunately, you know, a lot of the folks that Land and Legacy works with are into the holistic just land management. I want to work with the land anyway, and that's that covers all those bases anyway.
Sure. Yep.
But this guy, you know, three specific species, so we got to come at it from an angle of, you know, how and where can we get these things and make this work. And it was a really interesting property in the fact that, so it's only 240 acres. The east part of it, the east third, is used to be farmed not that long ago and then let go. And
a lot of old pasture stuff.
Yeah, so basically it's old field, but our kind of old field would be way more delightful than his old field. If you let something go from farming it and you let it go for 5 or 6 years in North Central Texas, you have mesquite
flat
every 20 feet.
Yes.
So that's what he has, that's what he's up against. So
correct.
All of a sudden, wow, we've got to deal with this. Then the center one third is this nice mix of, he's got mesquite scattered around, and of course the herbaceous layer, he's got a variety of stuff going on, some good stuff here and there, a lot of ragweed, no cattle on this farm right now, but had a, you know, the croton and ragweed, and but he also had post oaks in this middle third, and kind of some, you know, timber that deer were utilizing. In fact, he admitted, hey, this is my most deery,
most productive
area.
Yeah,
this middle third
section here,
and then this west third is as bad a solid cedars as I've ever seen anywhere in the universe.
It's rough. It's thick.
There's post oaks in it, but it just, so he's got, you know, one third of the property that's basically completely unusable for any of the wildlife species we are targeting. We did see three different groups of hogs that, so
which is we'll get into it, but kind of remind me in the conversation to go back to some of the improvement of the habitat that is going to be done in that portion of the property, the thickest, heaviest, densest cedar, and what that then response wise will be to help decrease the likelihood and expectancy usage of hogs in that property, portion of the property, but we'll get there.
Yeah, so, you know, this back to, so it was almost like three different, completely different habitat types on the same 240 acres. So our prescriptions become completely different. Yeah, we're still all within the same 21-inch rainfall. We're still worried about these same three species of wildlife. But, you know, on that mesquite flat stuff. We got to deal with the mesquite, first of all, so we can get to where we want for herbaceous
correct.
Stuff.
Yes. Get, like, peel the top bad layer off.
Yep.
Then to be able to work with everything else.
Yep. So, and he's, you know, he's got little blue and broom sedge and some different. We've got some good quality potential quail nesting and brood rearing already mm-hmm. there.
Yeah.
But the mesquite, it's just, it's all going to be gone very soon with the mesquite. So,
and explain that. So from a shading out sunlight.
Yeah. I mean, it's just going to get to where that's all that's there. And of course for quail, we want some level of brushy, scrubby stuff, which this guy also had, fortunately. I mean, he had a variety of the woody component is never going to be an issue on his farm.
Correct.
Not in the, he didn't have, you know, plum thickets like we have, but there's this a variety of species of stuff that he had going on. And even, you know, he had some big clumps of prickly pear cactus. So,
oh yeah,
I mean, that has a function in the quail world as well. So,
and what was the other one, the needle cactus?
Yeah, something that he warned us absolutely don't
do
touch
not get
it,
yeah, stuck by that.
So we didn't.
But another, like, if you will, from a structure standpoint, something woody wise that would have been useful,
yeah,
usable space from a structure cover standpoint for quail.
Yep. And so on this front, you peel, and he already knew it. Hey, I've got to grub out all this mesquite. So
yeah,
he already knew before we ever said a word that, man, this has to happen.
Right.
This has gotten too far along.
Yep.
You know, looking at parts of it that were open enough, though, then the next step is going to be, hey, you got some broadleafs in here, but we're going to really need to work to increase the broadleafs for brood rearing.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be some pretty good quail and turkey brood rearing habitat.
Sure.
If we get all this mesquite off of here, but we're going to have a disturbance, be it fire, maybe it's some dormant season disking.
Yep.
I see that being an easier tool in that part of the world.
Sure.
We will prescribe that he do some fire, but in 21 inch rainfall, if he's only relying on fire, there's going to be some years he can't burn without
correct.
Burning up the whole county. So,
I mean, for instance, it was the last day of September.
Yeah.
Yesterday, we were down there. It was 90 degrees as a high, and it started really nice, pleasant in the
yep.
morning, mid 50s, I'd say.
Yeah, I had a sweatshirt on.
Yeah,
yep.
And it climbed, right, but it got to 90 degrees, and the relative humidity that day at 90 degrees, the end of September, was only 16%.
Yeah.
I mean, if a fire was burning there 16% with that thatch layer, it would have been very difficult to stop. And I don't, we're not saying this to scare people about prescribed fire, but it's simply you have to know what your conditions are and be burning responsible time frames with the right proper humidity levels. Like, if that's going to be happening in Missouri, 16%, you know, those are days we're not going to be burning. We're going to be waiting for days that are, let's say, less volatile conditions.
Well, and we need to prescribe things that are, you know, a couple options for folks like this. We don't want to put him in a situation where it's, man, these guys said I have to burn and I can't burn because it's a drought year and all's for naught. Well, no, we have some alternatives, you know. Would I prefer fire? Sure. But, hey, we can get here with some dormant season disking, I think, on
mm-hmm.
some of these acres.
Mm-hmm.
He had in this front third, he had a lot of cheatgrass.
Yes.
Not ideal. Cheatgrass, it cheats the cheats the cattle.
It's a non-native, invasive, aggressive growing deal.
Yep, so it's taken up all the bare ground between plants. All
mm-hmm.
the stuff that I want for quail chicks, to quail adults to be mobile, you're losing it with this cheatgrass. So, you know, that'll be one of the tools to combat that, is if we time some disking right, he can increase the forbs and decrease some of that cheat.
Yes.
So it kind of interesting. he's got to remove that headache of mesquite first, but then we'll be able to work on something else. When he does that, this third was, I mean, it was just mesquite. Like, yes. There was nothing else in a big portion of this.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually going to be light on woody cover for quail.
Sure, yep.
So
yep.
We're going to recommend some down tree structures, some things to create some temporary covey, you know, covey headquarters, escape cover for quail. If he wants them to occupy those acres, that's what we're going to have to do to mitigate for that.
And explain real quickly what that down tree structure is and how someone might go about putting that in place on their own property if, let's say, if shrubs are hard to come by or the woody component is difficult to get regenerated, maybe because they got a high deer population.
So, yeah, we want to take – you can just cut some trees down. He's going to be cutting a lot of trees.
Uh-huh.
We'll find out more as we go through this podcast, or even some of these mesquite that he grub out. Back home, we'll do it with hardwoods. We'll cut down a tree, and we'll just take the top out of it and drag it out into the middle of a field. So if we've got fields where we don't feel there's adequate shrubby cover, and I want it every, say, 100 yards, I want a thicket, well, I'll just make basically a – not a brush pile. I don't want something dense enough a raccoon's going to live in it.
Mm-hmm.
But literally just a couple treetops, a down tree structure. Move that out there and scatter those every 100 yards across the landscape. And what will happen, short term, that provides structure that quail can get underneath and
yep.
be protected from overhead. You'll even get turkeys nest in those
sure.
sometimes. So it gives them some security from raptors. But what also happens then is birds perch on these, and they poop out seeds.
Absolutely.
And so you get this flush of other woody cover coming on. So long term, after you've burned and done a couple things in this field, those down tree structures after a few years have broke down. But now we have this flush of woody growth coming
mm-hmm.
right up through it. And I don't care on this farm if it's mesquite that comes back up through it.
Sure.
We don't want this whole field to be mesquite, but islands, motts of it,
yep.
that'll provide great escape cover. So
definitely. So that's a perfect definition of that down tree, but basically supplementing a hardwood thicket, a mott, some sort of shrubby cover for the time being. So that addresses quite a bit of the open areas that the property is dealing with, but then kind of migrate into what the remainder of the farm would have looked like and the techniques applied to there. And one of them, you know, I guess from a stressor standpoint, a lot of people hear us talk about, you know, the importance of woody browse. Now, got to go to the region, right? Like, yeah, Texas in this portion, it can get cold at night. I mean, they can experience some cold temperatures. He showed us pictures of a 5-inch snow there they had last year. So, you know, do they have long extended periods where the woody browse is as necessary as it may be in Illinois, Northern Illinois, Pennsylvania, New York? No, it's not. But that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be present. So I'll let you kind of explain more about, like, how we're going to accomplish some of that features and keep it in the right stages and levels throughout this kind of middle section of hard mast, herbaceous, grassy, but still offering some bedding type cover.
Yeah, this middle section was interesting. So there's post oaks with pretty good acorn crop on
mm-hmm.
them this year. And it's probably the function of birds sitting on the post oak limbs. But every post oak, so listeners, you know, picture this. This is not as open as a savanna, but somewhere in between. Picture there's a post oak every, I don't know, what, 40?
I was going to say 40 yards.
40 yards.
Yeah. 30, 40, something.
But within the drip line of every post oak.
And that's not an exaggeration. Like every
from the trunk out to the drip line, the tip
yes.
of the, there's 10 cedar trees under every post oak.
Yeah. And then in between all that mixture is your random elm and mesquite
yep.
growing among all the other herbaceous stuff.
Yeah. And so lots of elm, and man, it was getting pounded too. They're browsing it.
They're literally shaping the tree by the browse intensity of that species there on this property.
And you find, you know, where their sprouts are coming up and they're just pounding it. It looks like a little bush.
Mm-hmm.
But then of course you got elm trees that have gotten out of reach. So that, you know, talking to him about cutting, hey, you just cut this. Cut it back down and let it stump sprout, and boy, he was really, you know, excited to see that. And it's very visual. You can point and say, look, they're eating this. This is what they want. All that, the acorns were already starting to fall, which is pretty common in drier environments and falling early. And so that's obviously a food source as well. There's ragweed. There's greenbrier scattered all over and just getting grazed really or browsed really heavy. So, you know, able to point out a lot of things that are happening. And he recognized the shortfall on these post oaks of these cedars are sucking the life out of these post oaks. They had a fair amount of acorns on them, but think about what 10 cedars at the base is fighting for.
It's like two hands around someone's neck, right?
Yeah.
Choking, robbing nutrients, competition. And the other aspect of it was, now, since you've got the shade of a post oak and such dense growth of cedars, what you've really created underneath of all this is a place that pigs are rooting around and spending a lot of the day, but it's growing so dense underneath that deer don't have the ability to really navigate through that and utilize that shade component from the post oak. It's just so thick that you're really making it far better for the pigs that are on the property than the deer that are on the property.
Or even get to a lot of the acorns that are falling.
Correct.
Because they're falling into this miniature cedar forest that's underneath the post oak. So removing, he'd already done a few. He'd had some clearing done and he'd taken some out, and just the regen under these post oaks was being browsed.
Oh,
it looked like you ran over it with a lawnmower.
Yeah, that was the other crazy thing was, in some of the other areas that had the cedar removed, all that gamma grass down in there. Mm. Sorry, listeners. A little sidetracked. But underneath of those post oaks where the cedars were removed, it was amazing to see just how many oak sprouts were coming back. We're talking hundreds of oak sprouts, and they were being browsed very heavily versus the areas that you had full cedar underneath of them, there were zero oak sprouts coming back.
Yeah.
None. And very little usage from the wildlife he's looking to truly promote on the property. He's taking advantage of the hogs being there, but it's not like he's wanting to really design a property around trying to increase hog activity. He didn't need to do that. They were there.
Right. Well, and so this middle section, he'd also told us, you know, on the first kind of question and answer before we went looking around, this was his best deer part of the farm.
Yeah.
The west part, solid cedars. Doesn't. First of all, you can't hunt it. You can't see 10 yards.
Mm-hmm.
But he just doesn't get deer use, doesn't even see deer really coming or going out of that stuff. The front, that's mesquite flat. Yeah, some deer use.
They feed through more or less.
But yeah, they're filtering through it. There's really not a lot of food in that right now. So this center that had the post oaks had a lot more diversity. Well, that's where most of his deer hunting activity is occurring. Well, that's great, but it's only on a third of your farm.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's
some opportunities to cut some stuff, add cover, add security to this part of the farm, and increase the food availability for deer.
Oh, yeah.
That also, this same middle section, you know, had little blues, had a herbaceous component, had ragweed, had croton, had a nice variety of broadleafs in there. Found some sunflower species.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real opportunity, and that's where he said he also sees turkeys, by the way. So
yes. Go figure. It sounds diverse, right?
Yeah. But, man, all the stuff we want him to do for deer with some cutting and some changing is going to improve it for turkeys as well. And I'd say currently it's questionably usable for quail.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely will be usable space for quail when he does all of this. So
I think the other important aspect is the movement of the wildlife on this property in correlation to a neighboring property. The other property, neighboring property, had a large ag field. He's got a great relationship with his neighbors, which strongly encourage, because it's benefited him a lot. And so he's taking advantage of that. But he's recognized this corridor a lot from turkey usage, but then a lot of facilitating deer movement back and forth too. And so when in looking at the features of this property, that middle section, as well as that very, very dense eastern portion, how is the management going to be revolving around that additional corridor that we want, that we recognize, we can easily see, but we want to basically accentuate that.
You're talking the corridor that was going off of the neighbor?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
So on this neighbor to the north, there's these mature oaks, this stringer of mature oaks. And he says, oh, yeah, deer funnel through that onto his on and off of his property, same as the turkeys. That's where they're roosting right now. So that's good information to have, and we need to utilize that to our advantage. So we obviously can't manipulate that. And we don't necessarily want to, but if we know that's where a lot of the deer are coming and going, then that's where we want to do some of that first habitat work to accentuate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we want to build off of that. If he's going to be spending 5 years implementing a management plan, well, do we want to spend the first 2 years as far as possible from all of his deer activity? Probably not. Let's start where the heaviest activity is and expand out. So using that information and trying to work with the travel corridors that are already there will be really important. There was another unique feature that this guy had was part of this used to be a hog running pen. And they actually, around the barbed wire perimeter on some of this, then they had put hog panels up. So when they would dump hogs in here, they couldn't get out. So umpteen years ago. Well, there was a hog panels, and he was already removing some of these. He knew they were detrimental. We didn't tell him anything earth-shattering, but just something that sometimes people may not think about. Well, this nice stringer of mature oaks that left onto the neighbor that he says the deer and turkey use as a travel corridor to connect to a northern ag field back and forth to his property. Well, there's hog panels all along this thing.
Yeah.
Well, he's got a kid that hadn't killed a turkey yet, but they've been trying.
Yep.
Tried last spring. Just, you know, old enough to really start hunting. Kid's 11. His son's 11. And, well, man, there's hog panels all. This is where the turkeys are coming and going.
Yeah.
We got to get the first place I'm tearing down hog panels is
right there.
Right here.
Yes.
This is a priority.
Yeah.
Turkey's still going to have to duck a barbed wire fence, but. That's better than trying to make one fly over a hog panel fence. So
Right. Even
just little details like that that are impeding travel onto his property, man, we can fix that pretty quick. Let's just pull
really
those
quick.
Off the fence.
And that's why I think it's important, again, to have that relationship there with neighbors, because you're sharing wildlife. So don't worry about... Like if wildlife are doing something and utilizing a resource on a neighboring property, it would be honestly kind of foolish to try for him to try and stop that type of activity. Because guess what? He's not going to stop it. They're going to go in and around because there's a desirable resource over there that truthfully there's no place on his property that can compete with that. So we're not going to compete with that. We're going to try and increase, honestly, a corridor so that he can not only pull deer off of that food resource that's up there, but bring them back to his property and offer far better cover than the other property will ever be able to offer because of its nature of being very wide open and also having a very strong cattle impact as well. So we're going to try and enhance the features that he can have on his property, but base it in and around some of the corridor and the natural movement of deer on this property, to and from his property.
Yeah, and another feature you mentioned earlier, circle back to, is water. So we're in this 21-inch rainfall country, right? So water's a top commodity.
Could be a very limited resource.
Well, this guy, on 240 acres, he had five ponds.
Yeah.
One of them's a lake.
No, it is just a lake.
It's 3-4 acre lake. Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, like, build my house overlooking this.
It's beautiful ravine down through there, but just a fantastic amount of live water. Well, I didn't say live water on this place, and it was a humongous asset to the property.
Yeah, I mean, so now all of a sudden, hey, we're not worried about, you know, dry times of the year, stress periods that deer. Well, heck, this is our only water, or we don't even have water, and they're going on. So this guy's got that covered.
Done.
It's a non-issue for quail for the most part. They don't need standing water. They get it from dew and eating insects and this and that. But for other wildlife, you know, that's a critical component. So nice distribution of water, and how animals move and utilize that. And his family's fishing. They've gotten into fishing.
Yep.
Great. Said his daughter, she's 9, has really gotten into fishing, outfishes the boy, makes fun of him. That's a good time. Every family likes the good old ribbon.
Yep.
So, just all those things play into how these animals are going to move across the landscape.
And truthfully, in relation to those water features as well, we know that there's going to be a lot of movement kind of from one to another. So we're going to honestly build off of that as well. And some of the features of defined travel corridors are going to be built in and around. We're going to utilize basically some of the fingers and drainages and some of the topography features that would flow into these water systems as additional corridors to move deer, create pinch points between different habitat types. Because again, here we've got standing water on 5 different ponds that are occupying a pretty good chunk of land. Well, let's sandwich them in between some of these ponds, and now we've created a beautiful pinch point that makes, you've got great access from 2 different ways on many of them, and now we're bottlenecking deer. Hey, absolutely, I'm going to do that. And so we're increasing usage, wildlife usage throughout the whole place based on not only topography, but additional features, or creating new features to work off of.
You bet. We use everything to our advantage to help him be more successful, help them have, you know, higher deer sightings per hunt. All kinds of opportunities to work off of there.
And so, kind of mentioned a little bit earlier, but going back to that hog situation, there's a realization, I guess, when it comes to the hogs here. He can, unless neighbors are really all working together in this very large area to reduce hogs very intensely, trapping, there's going to be hogs there. And this property, based on some of the water features, was always going to be attractive to hogs. But specifically, the easternmost portion of the property was so dense and so void of a lot of the green vegetation that would have been attractive to turkeys and deer and usage, just from a mobility standpoint. Hogs were the only thing that were utilizing it. It was very heavy shade component, but adjacent to the water. Well, he's like, if I want to go find hogs, I'm just going to go here. Like, they're there, 100%. But through the management, he wants to utilize them as another recreational opportunity. But he's like, I don't want to make the property more desirable to them, because regardless, I'm going to have them. I'm going to deal with them, right?
Yep.
They're always going to be there. But when we start addressing the reduction of cedar on those acres, on the eastern portion that is so, so thick, it's going to then, therefore, reduce the amount of time that hogs are staying on his property and competing for additional resources, or they're interfering with potential quail nests or turkey nests. We want to disrupt that. So we're although we're creating better habitat for deer, turkey usage on that specific portion, we're actually reducing the quality of habitat that the hogs are looking for.
Yeah, the hogs are using that portion kind of as a refuge. Mm-hmm. It's just solid, impenetrable garbage that, you know, for us to walk through, or a deer, an 85-inch deer couldn't run his antlers through this.
No.
No way, let alone a 160-inch deer.
Right.
But the hogs can scoot right under these cedar thickets, and they're using them to their advantage. I mean, mm-hmm. that's where they want to be. And some of the surrounding property has some similar characteristics of this,
yes.
by the way. So that's important yes. information, too. So we already know, and, you know, I've got a lot of experience. I've worked two different places and dealt with feral hogs in my job being a public lands manager. I know what hogs want. I know what habitat they're going to hole up in. So as we remove these cedars, which need gone anyway because there's zero usable space for deer, turkeys back in this stuff,
yep.
We need the herbaceous. We need to release these post oaks. That's going to push some of these hogs. They're still going to come and go off of them.
Yeah.
Like you said, they got the water. But they're going to start living more on the neighbor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That doesn't get rid of the problem, but it
displaces.
It sure eliminates the time, the occupancy
yes.
on this property. Well, the less time they're there, the less damage they do. So, and they'll still have opportunities to kill hogs. Back to controlling them, this guy's 2 hours away.
It's not feasible.
I mean, he's not running hog traps.
Right.
And his neighbors, one guy messes around with a little bit. Nobody on the other three sides does anything as far as trapping hogs. I mean, there's just eradication's not an option in this situation. So make the best of it. Manage the habitat against the hogs as best we can, and then he'll continue to shoot some, and they mm-hmm. like them. They eat them. He said they mm-hmm. kill about 10 a year.
Yep.
They're getting a little bit of recreation out of it. They're getting some good breakfast sausage out of it.
Yep, yep, you absolutely.
Know, smoked pork loin, and so
take advantage of that.
There's nothing wrong with that.
You
get lemons, you make lemonade.
That's right, that's right. So that kind of wraps up a lot of that property. You got one more?
Yep.
Go ahead.
We need to mention one more thing, really important. And
yep.
We're always bagging on this on these podcasts, and Adam and you, Matt, talk a lot about folks relying on food plots. So this guy, wasn't relying on food plots, but he had, you know, everybody wants to have food plots. It's fun. You like to do it, right? So he had just planted this food plot.
Mm-hmm. And he had just seen it green, germinating, growing.
Yeah.
Like 2 days prior to us being there.
Yeah. 21-inch rainfall country, plants the fall food plot.
Yep.
Gets 10 inches of rain out of these last hurricanes.
Yep.
I mean, this couldn't
this
be
was
more
dream world
perfect.
For him.
Like, this is ideal. This is the best food plots he's ever going to have. I mean, it was just one food plot. I don't know. What was it? Maybe a couple.
2.5-3 acres.
Yeah. So, you know, he's not relying on, but point is, they've got to stand over this food plot.
Mm-hmm.
They've killed deer
mm-hmm.
over it. This is an important feature to him.
Very centralized, a nice feature.
Neighbor texts him, says army worms have arrived.
Boom, boom, boom.
And we walk out into this field, and I mean, he's just, his jaw hits the ground. He's like, I was here 2 days ago, guys.
Yeah.
And this was...
I could see blades, leaflets of wheat that were what would have been easy 6-7 inches tall.
Above your ankle.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's done.
It's
there are
dirt.
Millions
yes.
of army worms crawling around this field. In
yes.
2 days, they've wiped it out. So, once again, reliance on that.
And guess what they weren't eating, right?
Yeah, the native
The
foods.
Native forage.
Yeah, they're not eating the greenbrier. They're not eating, so... Luckily, this guy has some other stuff. He'll be fine.
Oh, yeah.
He'll have deer. But, man, if you're relying on something like that,
Put your eggs in one
you
basket.
You finally get rain, you get army worms.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm glad we don't deal with that, knock on wood.
Right. So, that was a great point to certainly bring up. But, you know, there's that property in that portion of Texas, just it has different, oh gosh, different challenges and different ways to address those challenges to meet those objectives for the landowner. Although, again, the priority was deer, turkey, and quail. So, contrastly, let's take us to today and where we just wrapped up the 480-acre property consultation, spent the day working with the landowner and his friend and toured the property. It was a very, I think 320 acres was pasture, but he had a lot of additional area that we could really get very aggressive with from a wildlife habitat related aspect. You know, we're going to make improvements and suggestions for the tenant cattle operator to improve, you know, through rotations, adding in additional forages to the bahia grass base in those pastures. But all in all, this property in its size, like, we're going to be able to do a lot. But this is east Texas, almost into Louisiana. I'd say we're probably 20 miles from Louisiana, something like that. So, you know, this is vastly different country, species, composition on this property. Yet a lot of the same general principles still apply, but the way we go about them and the way this landowner will take these recommendations and then begin to manage this property is vastly different from 4 hours west of him. So Kyle, kind of walk us through what that property had and ways to address and create the desired features that it takes to grow, produce quality deer and turkeys on this place.
So this guy's western two-thirds is pasture, like you mentioned, bahia grass mostly, but within that he's got these some finger draws that come out, some wooded draws that it's a pine, sweet gum. There's oak,
some hickory,
just this mix. But he's talking about, and there's a major highway, by the way, on right on this west edge, so
yeah,
like a four-lane highway. Talking about, hey, I just don't see much deer activity over here. Well, these draws, that there's one main creek that's cutting through all this pasture. The draws that are coming off of it are just these finger draws that are going up a couple 300 yards, but this dead end out in this
dead in the middle
of these pastures. So it's pretty obvious, no reason for a deer to go out there.
It would be like dropping me off in the middle of New York City. I would start looking around and be like, okay, where's like Central Park? Where can I see a tree? Like, yeah. Where do I go? What's home to me? It would be like the same thing for deer to be dropped off in the center of that pasture. Something bad happens. If they're caught out there, cornered out there, where do they go? Well, they're not going to put themselves in a place where they don't have escape cover. Like, that makes them super, super vulnerable. Well, it's not very good usable space.
Yep, and within these little draws, there is some good food. I mean, found American beautyberry like crazy
littered
down the sides of these draws. Like I said, there is some oak. There's greenbrier. There's
blackberry, partridge pea.
Yes, they're browsing on all this stuff, and we're pointing this stuff out. And so it's exciting. The species are there.
Sumac was there.
Yep.
I mean, it had all the right components, just not – distribution of those components was sporadic and poor, but it's like, man, we can work with what we're getting with here.
Yeah, a lot of it was just dead end to nowhere.
Yeah.
And so then you transition to the east part of the property, and you got into, he had a section he called the sanctuary, but essentially, you know, 100 acres of this that's not pasture.
Yep.
Well, here's where we get into, so we're in this 50-inch rainfall situation, and that's all well and good. There was even some swampy, interesting stuff he had going
that could be
that he doesn't see many deer, but it was wide open underneath. Yep. Certainly could be enhanced and will be enhanced.
And choked out with Chinese privet.
Yep.
And a couple other very, because of the structure of the privet and it holds its leaves so long, and the vine action around it, there was very little sunlight ever getting in.
Yep.
It was very unusable, despite being what could be and will be in the future a great corridor for moving deer.
Yep, travel corridor and the
turkey usage too, because the willow oak and stuff that was in there, I mean, some of that stuff was perfect size for turkeys.
Yep.
Perfect.
Yep, little tiny acorns, perfect for them to eat. Well, not only are we dealing with this different rainfall situation, but again, pass management.
Mm.
So we get over into the timbered portion of this property, and again, there's a mix of pine, but you're looking around and you're like, wow. So there's a handful of pine that are, I don't know, we had some 16, 18 inch pine, probably.
Something like that. Yep.
And then 90% of the rest of the timber is 5-inch DBH or smaller.
Yes.
I mean, smaller, your
like
forearm
think
or
high
smaller.
Stem count and then go to the next level.
Yeah.
Like way overstocked, clear cut area, left, nothing happened since.
Yeah. So this past history, you're standing here looking saying, okay, we're in a, so when did the clear cut happen?
Yeah.
I mean, you already know what happened.
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
I think 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, that would have been great, except there was no follow-up management, so now we're back to...
8-9 years ago, this was fantastic.
Oh, boy, yeah.
But nothing's happened.
So we've missed the fire. Now it's too big. We're not going to kill any of this stuff with fire. Some of it's even starting to have some cedar encroachment that's beyond fire killing. So we're back to mechanical. We're going to be back to some chainsaw work or skid steer work and some bedding thickets. And that opens a whole nother can of worms, you know.
Yep.
We're looking at this whole thing is usable for a deer. It's certainly not ideal. High stem count. There's food in here. I mean, there's beauty bear. There's all this stuff, but it's really not expressing itself very well. It's struggling. It's agonizing in the shade.
Potential is like a 10, but actual in this condition is more or less like overall cover. I mean, I'm going to give it maybe a 4. That's generous.
And probably, you know, he's talking about deer and how they use this place. And no doubt, deer are bedding in this. The problem is it all looks the same.
Exact same.
So you don't know where any of these deer are bedding. Yeah, they're bedding in this.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're walking to the stand in the dark, you may or may not just, you know, put your wind on the deer you were hoping to hunt the next 3 days.
Yep.
And that's it. He's done. Left the property and...
Like bounded off and right.
Your target deer just left in the dark and you didn't even know it. So, obvious no-brainer, first step.
We got to break up the continuation of just 12-year-old clear cut.
Yep.
Mechanical means, bedding thickets, chainsaws, getting in there, getting aggressive, and just dropping, going right back to year, like, 0 or 1 or 2 from a regeneration standpoint. And with... Kind of going back to the topic of the podcast, and with 50 inches of rain.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. That regrowth, holy cow, it's going to blow up in there. I mean, it's going to be incredible in just in a year's time frame. But, again, they had, from a beneficial standpoint of the things that could regenerate there, ample American beauty bear.
It was
not close to expressing its full potential, but it was everywhere already. Then there's black gum. We saw red maple. We saw a lot of flowering dogwood. We saw elm. And
there was greenbrier and this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, those types of – that regeneration is going to be huge in those bedding clear cuts. And so I think – obviously, that's like 80 grand. We're going in there. We're doing that. That's number one. No brainer. But then we had this other kind of like decision to make, let's say from a recommendation standpoint or the rest of this stuff. Like, what happens to, we can't make the whole thing feasibly with chainsaws, a bedding thicket, right? Nor are we going to prescribe that? But down the road, and based on his region, he's got paper mills.
Yep.
And so he's able to get to a standpoint with the current condition of the regeneration to a harvestable point much quicker than many areas that are, you know, any other type of hardwood mill, right? So he's got the ability to, you know, in a few years after it matures, I shouldn't say matures, after it grows more, gives more tonnage, they can come in and actually have an income off of that timber, but then also have a giant amount of labor force done and get paid to do it. So it doesn't make sense to manually go in there and do absolutely treat every acre TSI when we've got a paper mill close by.
Yep.
We can let them do a lot of the work, and then from there, after that happens, we can manage those acres a lot differently. We can change up the fire interval. We might be able to do some areas that are much less in the return of fire, so maybe 3 years versus some areas that are 6 years on fire. And whereas in the western central portion west of this area, the other property, we didn't have that option because you're not going to be burning every 2 years out there, or you're not going to have anything to burn.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to anyway. That right. Guy, you know, you can see the effects of a burn in north central Texas 3-4 years later. 50 inch rainfall country, you know, you've lost the effect of that burn within a couple of years in a lot of cases. So certainly it will prescribe a higher fire return interval, and he can maintain this habitat. So, but there will be this little temporary, hey, let's do this, let's do A, B, and C, but we actually want you to wait, time out on some of these acres, and wait until it hits the pulp stage, and then must market it that way. So you can get a bunch of labor done, because, man, I wouldn't want to try to TSI it the way it is right now.
I don't even know. Talk about work. I mean, I love TSI, but I don't want to do TSI in that stem count. Like, in some areas, you couldn't have, like, even if you're utilizing Hackensquirt, you wouldn't have been able to swing a hatchet. It was so dense. This is not that feasible to even attack. Honestly, it's this weird in-between mixture of, do I sit here and we're not ever doing anything idle, right? But do I need to let it get to a stage, advance some more before it just makes way more sense to then apply a new technique to it? And in this case, in this situation, based on his region and the resources there, yes, that's like the most simple out, if you will, an option for him.
Yep, absolutely. And you know, thinking about all this work, just another thought popped in my head. Both of these guys kind of said, hey, is there any help on any of this stuff? Meaning finance, you know, first guy had already talked to somebody about federal cost share through EQIP program. You know, the guy today didn't really know what EQIP was. So we explained some of that, and I don't know if he'll get in or not. There's a scoring system to it, but there are programs out there. So, you know, we're going to put that in the plan and say, hey, you know, go talk to your local office, find out what the possibilities are. And with all these practices that we're recommending, the more practices you do in some of these programs, the higher your score is. So, you know, there's a higher possibility that they do get accepted into the program.
Right.
And all of a sudden, hey, somebody's given me some money to help offset this cost, or now I can hire a skid steer to do this instead of me just doing it all myself with a chainsaw, or, you know, kind of helps give you some more options in a lot of cases. Some people don't care. Some people are like, hey, whatever, you know, I'll pay for it. But some folks are like, hey, I want to
look into that. I want to see what those options are. Can it help me, or is it going to hurt me, or is the timeline going to match my aggressiveness in trying to get this work done? May or may not, but it's worth looking into. in many cases, to see if that's a feasible option.
Yep. Yeah, there's no harm, no foul, no application fee. Just
see if it works out.
There's opportunities there. Most states, there's state cost share, too. We've talked about that. At my own farm, I couldn't get an equip this year in Kansas. Didn't really fit what I was wanting to do. But, you know, state cost share. Biologist said, hey, I'll hook you up. I'll cover you. So I'm going to get a little help for stuff that I was already going to do.
Planning on doing it.
Spraying Cerisa and putting in a pollinator planting and spraying some Johnson grass. And I was going to do all that anyway. But
might as well make some money with
it. Got somebody giving me some money to help cover the seed costs and the herbicide costs. So instead of, you know, costing me $1,000, I'm going to get paid a little for my labor and all most of my expenses paid for.
Yeah, you're going to pocket some of that. So cool.
Yeah.
You know, one of the other big things that you think about this property here that we were on today, this eastern property, that has a heavy cattle component, but also has, 160 acres worth of timber on it. I think what oftentimes we may not talk a lot about like on the podcast, but I think it's very important is discussing like the movement of wildlife from one resource to the next. You look at the property today on the eastern portion, your 12-year-old clear cut. In the very center and western portion, we're bahia grass pastures. When you go from like super dense to wide open, there was a giant void of usage of this property. Yeah, I mean, we have the cattle and that income and the usage of that property to work with. Like, we're not throwing it out the door, but we still have to keep in mind of how do I make this more usable? And it just, the way you design and the way that you place certain features or encourage certain plant communities to develop and grow throughout your entire property is going to change the way wildlife use your property. So you have to consider the placement spatially across a property on a landscape before you even ever do them. Like, does it make sense to put this here? Can I put this here? If I put this here, will deer walk here or will they walk there? Or will they walk around this one feature? Can I create a pinch point? Are they then going to my neighbors? All these different questions should be running through your mind. But, we've talked about on the podcast, how many times do people just see this opening like, yep, planting a food plot. It's going there. Why? Well, because it's an opening. I can just spray it out and I can just plant it. Yeah, we need to consider that more. Just because you see an opening doesn't mean that it should be a food plot. Same thing with the rest of these features that we're talking about, whether it's a bedding thicket or whether it's brood rearing cover or whether it's nesting cover. We've got to consider point A to point B, especially for something, Kyle, like your emphasis, quail. Like, quail mobility and turkey poult mobility across the property, especially with bahia grass or these really high stem counts, or yesterday with a lot of cheatgrass on the central portion of Texas, like, we've got to consider how those species at different stages are going to move before we just start willy-nilly putting those types of habitat plant communities on a property.
You bet, and especially one of the biggest places that plays in with the stuff that, a lot of these consults are deer-centered.
Right.
And it's these bedding thickets. And people get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. You put in bedding thicket. But where?
Yeah.
And so people can understand maybe the mobility of, hey, I got to have enough bare ground between plants that a quail chick can move around.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start thinking about, well, I've got 75 acres of all the timber that looks the same. And we were in some contour today, by the way.
Yeah.
So where do you put these bedding thickets? Well, we need to consider all of that. It's travel areas.
Yeah.
Partially plays into that. But contours.
Yep.
Where's the sunshine? And you guys have talked about this, but where's the sunshine? And look, I don't just need bedding areas for hunting season. I need bedding areas. This is Texas.
365.
It gets hot.
So I need really hot.
I need some cooler bedding areas. Well, yeah. Guess what? We've got a swampy area. We've got a couple creeks on this property. We can work with that. And we have good airflow and cooler temperatures in the summer. Maybe for, you know, the hunting season, we're going to want these bedding thickets more on south and southwest facing slopes, you know, where they can get a little sun laying around in December. And so all of that's got to play into this stuff. And it was fun to kind of watch that. We went through that discussion with the landowner and his buddy today, because you could kind of tell that there was a moment in there of kind of the big eyed, like, oh boy.
You're asking me to do
these
what?
These guys are. I hear what you're saying, but
sounds important.
Where do I start?
Mm-hmm.
And then we start talking. Hey, we're going to give you that information, but we want you to understand of how we're coming up. This isn't. We're not throwing darts at the board.
These features. It's not just like, oh, hey, we've got this checklist. Make sure we've got brood habitat. Oh well, yeah, go there. Make sure we got nesting cover. Well, let's go. Let's go slap it over there. Bedding thicket check. It goes right here. Not just this, like I said, throwing darts at the wall and seeing where they stick. And like, no, there's a rhyme and a reason, and all the components you've talked about: topography, the way the sun shines, what kind of response we're gonna get from, you know, that bottom ground versus the upland soils. They're gonna produce different plants, and different communities, and wildlife are gonna relate to them differently. We've got to think about that.
Yep. So it was fun having that conversation with them, and you could tell the light bulb went off, and so all that's going to be in this plan. It's going to be neat. It's going to be neat to see how it plays out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, any other wrap-up thoughts here from you, Kyle, on just kind of Texas in general, and maybe, you know, there's someone who's got property or two different properties, and they're like, maybe I've just tried to approach them the same, when in all reality, they could be 20 minutes away, and the approach is completely different. They don't have to be 4 hours away and 30 inches of rain difference. You could have the exact same rains, but like, I think it's super important, despite being in the same state, we're approaching these two properties that like very differently. There's no cookie cutter aspect to this.
No, and there should not be. There never
Correct.
Should be. Every property is different. And honestly, you could give us the exact same acres of open field timber. You could give us the exact same layout 5 miles apart, and I guarantee you we're still going to manage them different, because the neighboring properties are going to look different and be managed different.
100%.
So it all comes into context, not just where you're at in the landscape climate wise what are your neighbors doing? Your neighbors shoot any deer that comes through? Is your neighbor a hunt club or it's a nobody hunts over there? This place today, there's a timber company to the east.
Yeah,
they just got
Lease
done
out.
With a clear cut.
Yeah
Well, guess what?
Yep, that's
and this guy
change.
Was talking about, man, I haven't been getting any hogs on camera, and my deer sightings are way down, and then we're tootling along.
Oh.
They just finished a clear cut.
Hello.
Well,
you've
lost some animals short term. It's pine, so it won't be long term. But anyway, all that plays into, you know, we got to figure out what we need here and whether we're competing with the neighbors or working with the neighbors or what's happening.
Yeah.
All of that matters.
For sure. Well, we're rolling back to Missouri right now. Guys, we hope you enjoyed the podcast and were able to pull some valuable tips and information out of this as we're comparing and contrasting approaches and properties here in Texas. And just a reminder that if you guys are interested in consulting services, reach out to Land and Legacy social media, but go into the website, click on the consulting tab, and send us an email through that page, or just simply go to and utilize info at Land and Legacy and send us an email. We'd be happy to talk with you about what it is we do, how we approach properties, and see if it fits for you and what you're trying to accomplish, really wherever you're at in the country. So actually, we're headed, Kyle, to Florida with Frank in about a week and a half. So we're excited for that. It's going to be fun. But we're going all over the place.
Be another deal. So guess what we're going to do there? Deer, turkeys, and quail.
Yep.
Same thing we did yesterday.
Yep.
Except there probably won't be 10 species of plants that are the same. I mean,
yeah,
it might as well be on two different planets.
Yeah, exactly.
But our philosophy is going to be the same. It doesn't matter. We know we'll work with what is there and make recommendations appropriately.
Absolutely. So, guys, appreciate you listening. Reach out to us. Share this podcast with who you think it may be applicable to. And, again, we appreciate it. And we'll catch you next week. Yep.